This hour of the Jason Rant Show is brought to you by the KTH smartphone app. If you don't have it, you should download it immediately. A lot of news happening all around the world and right here at home. So, let's find out what's trending.
What's trending? Happening now.
House Democrats are moving forward with their attempt to change the rules on impeachment, rules that give both the president's legal team and the House managers 24 hours each across 3 days to present their case to the American people. The Democrats so far today have spent their time explaining that they need more information to present, specifically documents that they'd like to subpoena. The Democrats just made their case trying to get documents coming from the Office of Budget Management. Now we've got Jay Sekulow, who is the President Trump personal attorney, who's there speaking against this resolution. We'll dip into live coverage right now on the Senate floor.
By the straightforward fact that the aid was delivered on September 11th, 2019, without Ukraine taking any action on any investigation. It's interesting to note that the Obama administration withheld $585 million of promised aid to Egypt in 2013. But the administration's public message was that the money was not officially on hold, as technically it was not due until September 30th, the end of the fiscal year. So they didn't have to disclose the halt to anyone. Sounds like this may be a practice of a number of administrations. In fact, to the president, this president has been concerned about how aid is being put forward. So there have been pauses on foreign aid in a variety of contexts. In September of 2019, the administration announced that it was withholding over $100 million in aid to Afghanistan over concerns about government corruption. In August of 2019, President Trump announced that the administration and Seoul were in talks to substantially increase South Korea's share of the expense of U.S. military support for South Korea. In June, President Trump paused over $550 million in foreign aid to El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala because those countries were not fairly sharing the burdens of preventing mass migration to the United States. This is not the only administration. As I said, President Obama withheld hundreds of millions of dollars of aid to Egypt. To be clear, and I want to be clear, Ambassador Yovanovitch herself testified that our policy actually got stronger under President Trump, largely because, unlike the Obama administration, quote, this administration made the decision to provide lethal weapons to Ukraine to help Ukraine fend off Russian aggression. She testified in a deposition before your various committees that, and actually I felt that in the 3 years that I was there, partly because of my efforts, but also the interagency team and President Trump's decision to provide lethal weapons to Ukraine, that our policy actually got stronger. Deputy Assistant Secretary Kent, names come up a couple of times, agree that javelins are incredibly effective weapons at stopping armored advance, and the Russians are scared of them. Ambassador Volker explained that President Trump approved each of the decisions made along the way, and as a result, America's policy towards Ukraine strengthened.
This is Jay Sekulow.
So when we want to talk about facts, go to your own discovery and your own witnesses that you called. This all supposedly started because of a whistleblower. Where is that whistleblower?
That was Jay Sekulow speaking on behalf of the president, arguing against.
The House managers have 35 minutes remaining.
Arguing against new documents being subpoenaed that House Democrats have asked for. Each get 2 hours, both sides, to argue this particular amendment that Chuck Schumer put out. Now it goes back to the House managers on the Democratic side. I believe it is Representative Jason Crow about to speak.
And yes, the aid was provided. It was provided by Congress. This Senate and the House of Representatives with the president's signature. The Congress is the one that sends the aid. And millions of dollars of this aid would have been lost Because of the delay, had Congress not actually passed another law that extended that deadline to allow the funds to be spent? Let me repeat that. The delay had jeopardized the expenditure of the money to such an extent that Congress had to pass another law to extend the deadline so that the money and the equipment got to the people on the front lines. Need I also reiterate the supposed interagency process? You know, the concerns that the president and his counsel continue to raise about corruption and making sure that the process went right. There was no interagency process. The whole thing was made up. It was a phantom. There was a delay, and delays matter. Mr. Chief Justice, I reserve the balance of my time for Mr. Schiff.
Mr. Schiff?
House Manager Adam Schiff is taken to the podium again. They're debating a Third Amendment to subpoena documents from the
Chief
Office
Justice,
of Management and Budget.
Just a few additional points I'd like to make on this amendment and on my colleagues' arguments. First of all, Mr. Sekulow makes the point that the aid ultimately got released. They ultimately got the money, right? Yes, they got the money after the president got caught, after the president was forced to relieve the hold on the aid, after he got caught, yes. But even then they had held on to the aid so long that it took a subsequent act of Congress to make sure it could all go out the door. So what, is the president supposed to get credit for that, that we had to intervene because he withheld the aid so long? And that's the only reason Ukraine got all of the aid that we had approved in the first place? My colleagues have glossed over the fact that what they did was illegal, that the GAO, an independent watchdog agency, found that that hold was illegal. So it not only violated the law, it not only took an act of Congress to make sure they ultimately got the aid. This is supposed to be the defense to why you shouldn't see the documents? Is that what we're to believe? Now, counsel also says, well, you know, he's not the first president to withhold aid. And that's true. After all, counsel says, well, President Obama withheld aid to Egypt. Yes, at the urging of members of Congress. Senators McCain and Graham urged that aid be withheld. And why? Because there was a revolution in Egypt after it was appropriated. That wasn't something that was hidden from Congress. That was a pretty darn good reason to think, do we still want to give aid to this government after this revolution? We're not saying that aid has never been withheld. That's absurd. But I would hope and expect this is the first time aid has been withheld by a president of the United States to coerce an ally at war to help him cheat in the next election. I think that's a first.
That is Adam Schiff, House Manager, speaking live on the Senate floor, making the argument that the Senate should subpoena documents from the Office of Budget and Management, documents that the House decided not to fight in court to get. So in other words, they're saying, we weren't able to get these documents. We still voted to impeach the president. Now, before you're able to take a vote, you need to get these documents. This is why one of the talking points coming from the Republicans today, both from the Trump team and analysts, is that the House is now asking the Senate to do the job that they should have done but chose not to do. And they know they're not going to get these documents. But they're doing this because they want to give off the appearance that there's something to hide. You're listening to The Jason Rance Show. There are, of course, other things happening all around the country and here in Washington State. So we're going to take a brief break from coverage of the Trump impeachment in the Senate. And with that in mind, let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? You can't make this up.
Democrats in Olympia are moving forward with a sex education bill, making it mandatory for all public students starting in kindergarten to go through this comprehensive lesson plan. Some of the lesson plans, frankly, are as controversial as you might expect them to be coming from some folks in Olympia. Joining me to discuss is State Representative Chris Corey, Republican from Yakima. Representative Corey, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me, Jason.
Would you want any of your kids getting some of the messages from these lesson plans?
It is scary. And the short answer is no. I want to make it clear that we, most House Republicans, we're not against all forms of sex ed. And if this bill was addressing issues pertinent to teenagers going through some of these situations, we'd be in a much different position. But what this bill does is it is comprehensive sex ed from kindergarten through high school. Now, the opponents for this legislation, or the proponents, are arguing that, well, it's just when it's younger, it's about healthy relationships and boundaries and understanding, you know, your body versus somebody else, which is all well and good until you actually look at the curriculum. And they're talking about almost anything but healthy bodies and healthy relationships. It's sexualizing our kids at far too young of an age.
Well, and some of the language that they use is very clearly driven, not necessarily by medical accuracy, which they'll use as a defense for their lesson plans. It's more of social commentary. I mean, the idea of telling a first grader, for example, that instead of some girls have a vulva, it's some people have a vulva. And really, it's just setting it up for later on down the line, talking about gender identity, which is something I want people to talk about, but I don't necessarily trust a progressive activist who's a teacher to talk about.
Well, and I mean, what you just said wasn't medically accurate, right?
Exactly.
So if this is about medically accurate education, then let it be medically accurate. There's a lot of stuff that will scare you here, and I know you probably have some more questions, but I want to point out for your audience. So we had a work group that went out to discuss and figure out what their recommendations were around this. And they came back with a unanimous, we need K through 12. But if you start digging into their data, they had actually did a survey, and I don't know if you've talked to your audience about this, but they did a survey of parents in Washington State. And of those surveyed, so over 10,000 people responded, 58% said they did not agree with K-12 sex ed. And I thought, wow, that's pretty interesting for this state. Well, what's even more surprising is that 44% of the respondents were from the Puget Sound area.
Yeah.
So to me, I'm surprised that number is as high as it is coming out of the Puget Sound.
Yeah, I was in the same exact place as you. And, you know, we talked a little bit about the survey yesterday, which, by the way, it's available, folks, online at ktth.com. This idea that you've got 13 people who have no ideological diversity, frankly, no gender diversity either on this group of mostly teachers and staff, some parents, coming up and openly saying, yeah, we didn't really disagree on anything. But you know what? The good news is we got the survey so we can hear from other sides. They just ignored the other side of the argument. They completely ignored it.
Well, and they even admitted it during hearing. They said, because I brought up the survey results because they're surprising, right? Given the recommendations out of this work group. And what I found was, they, when they looked at the comments, said, well, yeah, people don't want K-12, but they aren't opposed to sex ed at, you know, a later grade, 7th, 8th, whatever it is. And that was kind of like the duh moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think most people are, but putting it in kindergarten doesn't make sense to anyone, especially when you start looking about what we're talking about. So, Jason, I have 4 kids, and my wife and I have our comprehensive sex ed for our kindergartner and our third grader was, your body is your body. You don't put your hands on other people's bodies. And if somebody puts their hands on yours, you talk to a trusted adult. Done. I solved it in about 30 seconds. That's consent. That's, you know, a healthy relationship. Mm-hmm. And that's respecting your boundaries. We don't need anything more than that.
Yeah, and I generally agree with you. If you're just joining us, by the way, we're talking with State Representative Chris Corey, Republican from Yakima, about Democratic co-sponsored legislation that would force all public school students starting in kindergarten to go through what they believe to be comprehensive sex education lesson plans that include some very specific conversations with kindergartners about female and male body parts in ways that I'm going to presume that most reasonable adults probably think is a little bit too soon to have those conversations from your perspective, because, I don't want people to take away from the message here that Republicans don't want any conversations about sex ed. That's not what you're saying. That's not what I'm saying. That's not what most people are saying. But you are saying that there is a level of sort of appropriateness or not. So from your perspective, how do you determine what's appropriate?
So what we've argued, and you're absolutely right, we're not saying any of that. And our arguments have been and will continue to be, and we are going to offer plenty of amendments to support this, is that we believe that healthy sex ed when kids are entering an appropriate time of their life is fine, and that we would support that with, you know, carve-outs and caveats in there to help protect the rights of parents. Because I fundamentally believe parents do a better job of parenting than the state. That's my job. That's not the state's job. And if you look at, and I'm on the education committee, if you look at the history of it overall, we're not currently meeting a lot of our basics for these kids. So why am I going to tackle on sex ed when I've got kids that are being failed up through the education system, mm-hmm. who don't know how to read at an appropriate level, don't understand math? I mean, these are the problems we need to tackle. And when we offer a component that says, all right, let's look at seventh or eighth grade as starting those conversations, figuring that out, that's fine. That's a whole different discussion than what they're talking about here.
So last year this issue came up. It passed in the Senate. It died in the House. It died in large part because I don't think, you know, Democrats were ready for parents speaking out as passionately as they did. This time around, the legislation in the House is being co-sponsored by the chair of the Education Committee, who was the reason why it didn't pass last year. So politically, is there any reason to believe this year this legislation mandating kindergarten through 12th grade sex ed won't pass?
I think it's going to pass out of committee, but the fight isn't over. I mean, I've heard from hundreds of parents already, and we need advocates such as your show to be able to express this, because if people don't know, then it's harder for us to fight in the minority. But the more information I share and I tell people when I'm on the radio or meeting with people, I'll give you the curriculum. You can read it. I mean, if you want to play body part bingo in fourth grade, if you want your kids doing that, tell me you support that. Body part bingo in fourth grade. I want them learning, you know, algebra, mm-hmm. other things like that at a young age. I don't need them out learning how to have a fun bingo game about body parts and then talking about what that means to you. And some of this stuff gets even scarier when it gets older. I mean, there's lessons in here that talk about having teens go out and find out where they can buy condoms and how to get them, and then reporting back to their school about it, and removing any form of parental notification, mm-hmm. which the state has done a marvelous job at limiting a parent's rights to kids once they're over the age of 13.
So what can concerned parents realistically do in this? So obviously we're telling them about it. We're informing them about the issue. You guys can go to KTH.com and read about this, including, by the way, reading the entire very comprehensive lesson plan for K through 12. But beyond that, what do you suggest people do to actually make a difference?
So I would suggest that they come down to Olympia, that they speak with their legislators. They also need to speak with their school district, because a lot of the backlash I'm hearing, and something that, you know, I would consider as well, is people are saying, we're not just going to pull our kids out, and we're going to pull our kids out of these schools. And that has a financial impact to the school district. So you can talk about the economic impacts of having kids pulled out of school. But really what it's going to take is it's going to take a movement down here. We've seen other legislation last year, a hairdresser's bill, where mm-hmm. thousands of hairdressers showed up to fight for their rights to maintain their own business, and it stopped the bill. You have to have the groundswell. It can't just be us in the minority yelling about it, because we can only do that so much. But if it's parents from these school districts, again, it's not a rural versus urban thing. It was pretty clear from these surveys that a majority of people don't find this appropriate. So we need parents stepping up to say, this is my job. This isn't your job.
So not only showing up, but it's also important, because I know that a lot of people right now listening, let's say you're in Mukilteo and you can't make it to a hearing in Olympia at 1 o'clock on a Tuesday. You need to be calling your state representatives, call your senators, call your reps, make sure that they know where you stand on this issue and that you're not going to forget how they vote on this particular bill. If you text the keyword RANTZ, R-A-N-T-Z, to 1-800-465-8770, I'll send you a link to the story, to the bill, so you know exactly who's sponsoring it and you know exactly who you can talk to about this. Text R-A-N-T-Z to 1-800-465-8770. We've been talking with State Representative Chris Corey of Yakima. Representative, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. When we come back, it's time for the big local, where we ignore all things Seattle. Plus, we've got some more impeachment hearing to get back to and analyze.
Thank you. Bellingham, Bellevue, Shoreline, Tacoma.
This is the Big Local on the Jason Rant Show.
Olympia, Everett, Mercer Island.
Stories about you, not about Seattle.
Hey, look at the time, 4:30 on a weekday afternoon. That means it's time for the Big Local. Even on impeachment day, we are monitoring what's going on in impeachment. They just voted on a set of amendments to table. It appears that it passed along party lines, which means they're going to get to it after the next few days worth of opening statements. They're expected to take a recess for the next 30 minutes for dinner, which gives us plenty of time to talk about the issues you care about most while completely ignoring the city of Seattle. We start in Everett, where a veteran of the Afghanistan war ended up getting kicked out of a McDonald's. And now he's bringing attention to the story. There might be a lawsuit for discrimination brewing. His name is Jonathan Nagel. He was wearing a sort of this covered, curved blade around his neck. It's called a karambit. And apparently it falls under Washington's open carry law, which means he can carry it, but it does have to be visible.
It's a martial arts weapon. It's called a karambit. You know, I'm a martial artist. I'm not a type of guy that goes around attacking people.
Well, I mean, I see a lot of ninjas in movies who've got the masks on and full get-ups, and they're constantly just causing a whole bunch of problems. So why don't you let me decide whether or not you're going to be a bad guy?
What was the last ninja movie that you watched?
Producer Peyton, I saw Three Ninjas. I rewatched it. It's a movie from, I think, 1993.
I was really hoping you would say Beverly Hills Ninja.
No,
that's my favorite ninja movie.
That was a good one, though. I'll give you that. So this guy goes into McDonald's on Evermore Way, and the manager looks at this knife. Again, it's covered, but he's saying, whoa, 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 you're going to have to put that away. There are kids in the restaurant. I'm a little bit concerned. Now, Nagel comes back and says, look, I can't just do that. It would be against the law for me to do that. But after a little bit of a discussion, the guy finally agrees to put the knife away. So then he goes on to order his quarter pounder with cheese and whatever it was he was getting. He was there with some other friends, and there was some kind of verbal altercation that ended with him getting kicked out of the restaurant. Here he is talking with King Five.
Tried to tell him very calmly, but, letting him know that would be illegal for me to do that. It's supposed to be out in the open. And he said, no, I don't want your service. You can leave. Just that plain and simple.
So obviously he is upset with where he finds himself now, and he might sue.
So I fought for this country. I deserve to be here. I deserve a quarter pounder with cheese if I want one, you know. I don't deserve to be discriminated against. I'm in my country being treated like I'm some kind of criminal or foreigner, you know, that has ill intent, and I'm not.
Okay, so King Five says, Everett PD says no laws were actually broken on either side. A citizen like Nagel has the right to open carry, and he did nothing wrong. On the other hand, the manager had the right to use some kind of level of discretion regarding safety and actually refuse service. Now, that's just their basis on what they were told. I completely understand where Nagel is coming from. I am sympathetic to his position. I thank him so much for his service to this country. And shame on this dude in Everett at the McDonald's, who I think way overreacted. I don't think, however, it's discrimination. Or at least you're going to have a hard time making the case that this is discrimination in the state of Washington. I don't know if it's clear to the guy that he was a veteran, but let's say it was, because I haven't watched the whole video of the cell phone tape that the guy ended up uploading to YouTube. Let's say it was very clear that he is a troop. So he wasn't kicking you out on the basis of your veteran status. Thankfully, that's not this story, because if that was the story, that would change things remarkably, and we would be calling for people to be fired. But he took a position based on what he thought was best for the safety of the people in the store. Even though it's an open carry state, you can be asked to leave if you're not abiding by the policies that they have on the books. Now, it doesn't mean what the McDonald's manager here did was right. It doesn't mean that he shouldn't get additional training. And it doesn't mean that any of us out there talking about this story shouldn't completely side with the veteran. I just don't think it's discrimination. That's my position based on everything that we know. But again, thank you for your service. Thank you so much for what it is you're doing. And I'm sorry there are people in the state who get so freaked out at a 4-inch talon. I mean, I'll be honest, it does look kind of badass, and it was scary.
It's terrifying.
I was totally terrified, but Once the guy talks to me, I'm okay and we move on. I'm not the McDonald's guy.
If someone pulled that weapon on me in a fight, I'm just going to stop. I'm just, you know what? You won.
And remember, he didn't pull anything out.
No, it was just hanging.
It was in that leather covering. It does look like a velociraptor talon.
I kind of want one.
I do, too.
It's cool.
I kind of just want to walk around the studio with it. And then the folks over at Cairo Radio be like, oh, my God, do you see what Jason has? They'll be scared of me even more than they already are.
Jason has a weapon!
It's like, okay, relax, everybody.
I heard pop, 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 pop.
That is a neighbor describing the sound of a Thurston County Sheriff's deputy who shot a man that violated a protection order at a home near Lacey. It happened earlier today. Lieutenant Ray Brady says the man charged at the deputy when he was ordered to leave the house that he shouldn't have been in.
Male subject was tased by the deputy. The male then produced a knife, and the deputy fired shots in response.
So the dude was tased. He still fought back. He still was aggressive towards this officer. What happens when you pull a knife on a deputy, Producer Peyton?
You get shot.
You get shot. I prefer that the officers involved never have to use their weapon, but sometimes they do. And as a result, this guy...
The male subject is deceased here on scene. The deputy is approximately a six-year veteran of law enforcement. He's been placed on administrative reassignment.
Which is normal in all of this. Luckily, the deputy was not hurt, as they say in that interview with our sister station, Cairo Radio. The two people inside the home who called for help to remove this guy, it's unclear how they know this man. So, two things. Number one, understand that no officer, be it a Thurston County deputy or an Everett police officer, no law enforcement official wants to use their weapon. But they will use their weapon to protect themselves, to protect their partners, to protect the community when they have to. When you decide to get aggressive with a cop, when you decide to put their life on the line, I will 100% of the time back the officer, no matter what it is he does, in service of the community. When you pull a knife on a cop, you should expect that you are not going to survive that interaction. That should be a really good disincentive to pull any kind of weapon on a cop when you decide to use a car as a weapon. Understand, I want that cop to shoot you because I don't want you in that car or with that knife or with that gun or with that brick or even with your fists to hurt and or kill innocent people, including that cop. That's number one. Number two, understand that this officer didn't want to have to use that weapon, but now has to live with the fact, even though he is 100% right in what he did, he has to live with the fact that he took another person's life, even if it was justified. I don't wish that on anybody, certainly not a person who decides to put on a uniform every single day to serve the community that they love. And then number three, arguably the most important in all of this, this case is going to be used as a statistic to talk about how deadly cops are. You have websites that tally information of when cops use force, deadly force, in a community. They don't provide for you any of the context of what went on. They just say, here is yet another example of a cop shooting a civilian. They don't tell you that the civilian was armed. They don't give you any of that. They simply give you the raw stat. Here's another case of a cop killing someone in the community. And that stat then becomes politicized. It's the same thing. We've talked about this in the past, where Every Town for Gun Safety, for example, they are anti-gun. And so they want you to have a certain belief about school shootings. And so they'll say, look at how hundreds of school shootings, and we're not even, it's still just January. And you're like, hundreds of, really? I don't remember any school. I guess there was that one instance, that one, oh, wow, things are bad. We must have a serious problem with guns. We got to go after guns. And then, of course, you start to look at the data that they're citing. They will count, for example, as a school shooting, a drug deal that takes place at 2 a.m. in a parking lot of a school with adults who have no connection whatsoever to the school other than it was an empty parking lot that they can meet and do a drug deal that went bad. Someone gets shot or two people get shot and they call it a school shooting. That's dishonest. And so understand that this case, which is very clearly the appropriate way for this officer to respond, this is going to be used to forward a specific narrative that cops are bad, that cops are quick to use weapons, and you have to know that going in. So yes, we support this officer. Yes, we say this deputy was right, that I'm sorry this deputy had to do this, and frankly, I'm sorry that someone had to die in all of this, even if it was justified. But understand, it's now on you the next time someone tries to claim, oh, did you see that so many cop shootings here in Washington? There was that one case in Thurston. It's now on you to respond, whoa, 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 whoa. That was incredibly justified. Here are the facts of that story. That's why we deliver you these stories. It's not just about backing cops. That's an important part. But it's also about backing them by pushing against the really bad data that dishonest people, bad faith actors are pushing out there. So do you take the pledge with me in promising to fight back against these narratives? You're listening to The Jason Rants. And don't forget, we are on Twitter. Send me a tweet, twitter.com/JasonRants, or text the keyword Twitter to 1-800-465-8770. I'll send you a link so you can give me a follow. Welcome back to The Jason Rants Show. We are live on this Tuesday afternoon, an impeachment day. Right now, the Senate is in a recess. Amy Klobuchar is giving an interview right now to the press. Let's go to that live to see what she has to say. I believe these are the first statements from Senator Klobuchar, who, of course, is running for president after the impeachment hearing so far.
Beginning that I've got to do my constitutional duty. And it felt like, oh, hey, I know you guys want to be somewhere else, is what he was saying. I literally couldn't believe he did it, only because I think that this isn't the place to play those kind of politics, and we're all there to do our duty. We're going to sit there till the very end. We're going to listen to the evidence, and as I noted, I can do two things at once. I'm a mom, and I will find one way or another to run for president, and we are gaining momentum right now, but while I'm here, my job is to listen to this evidence, and one of the things I'd say that really struck me today as a former prosecutor is, number one, you don't put the evidence and the witnesses on at the end. You tend to do that at the beginning, and your questions should be of witnesses, not of trying to get witnesses. And then the second thing is, this is about the truth, and I don't know how my colleagues, many of whom I get along with and know well and have worked with, I keep looking over at them thinking, come on now, you know we should at least hear from Mick Mulvaney. You know we should at least hear from John Bolton. You can't have all these smoking gun emails out there and not get to the facts. And if the president believes that somehow this information is going to exonerate him, what is he afraid of?
So Senator Klobuchar is making a very bad faith case there. Very bad faith argument there. Because she was not taking that same position during the House impeachment. She wasn't taking that position. She didn't say to her Democratic colleagues in the House, to Nancy Pelosi and Jerry Nadler and Adam Schiff, whoa, 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 before you go ahead and vote on impeachment, before you send this over to our side, why don't you try to compel the subpoenas that you want to have enforced, compel via court to get the documents that you want, to get the witnesses to testify. The president is very clearly establishing an executive privilege. So you're not going to get Mulvaney. You're not going to get Bolton. Not like this, but you could go down, just literally down the street, and ask the courts to get involved. Because only then could you actually make the case. If the court says that privilege doesn't exist, turn over the documents, and the president refuses, then you've got an impeachable offense. In fact, if that were to happen, Republicans would be on board to impeach. I would be on board to impeach. Because that is actually a crime. But they chose not to do that. Amy Klobuchar, that entire time, was silent. Much like all of the Democrats have been silent. This is a horrible argument that they're making, and they want you to believe that the way this is supposed to be done is that you have the witnesses first, and then you do the arguments. That's not how impeachments are done. That's not how it was done during the Clinton impeachment. Now, I suppose you could make the argument that, you know what, that was then, this is now. This is 2020, man. We do things a little bit differently. And the argument in favor of impeachment, the crime, even though we didn't actually put a law that was broken in the articles of impeachment. This is so serious, we had to do things a little bit differently. No court in the world would do things this way. Okay, fine. Amy Klobuchar basically made that point, right? You're not supposed to, as a former prosecutor, you're not supposed to do the witnesses after you make the case. You're supposed to do it before. Okay. Again, if we want to go down that path, then she should say, as a former prosecutor, you know what she's going to do? She's going to recuse herself from a vote. Because she understands the conflict of interest. If she were to serve on a jury, she would be the first person to acknowledge if someone would actually ask her this question. If this were a traditional case, a traditional trial, would a judge allow you, Amy Klobuchar, to serve on the jury? You're running a campaign to replace Donald Trump. You very clearly have an interest in Trump being removed from office, because that presumably would make it a little bit easier for you to get into that position, Senator, fresh off of your co-endorsement from the New York Times. If she was asked that question, this is how she would dodge it. Well, look, this is not an official legal case like it is. This is constitutional, and I have the constitutional duty to step up and cast that vote. That's a bad argument. That's likely the argument that she would give. But you can say, well, a Supreme Court justice has also a constitutional duty to hear certain cases, and they recuse themselves when there is a clear conflict of interest, and that's pretty standard. So it's a bad argument that they're making, and they know it's a bad argument. They know it's a bad argument. Now, right now, we're in a recess for impeachment. The senators got 30 minutes, started about 10-ish, 15 minutes ago, so they can go get dinner and then return. What's happening on the Senate floor today, they are debating a set of amendments to change the resolution that outlines the actual rules for impeachment over the course of the next few days. Talked a little bit about it earlier, just a quick recap. Susan Collins, the senator from Maine, Republican, had concerns about the timeline. She didn't like 2 days for 24 hours apiece, 24 hours for the House Democrats to make their case, and then 24 hours for the Trump legal team. She said that's a little bit too packed. So they changed it. Mitch McConnell said, okay, we're going to change the resolution to 3 days. Now they put that up for a vote. Then Chuck Schumer comes in and he asks for a bunch of amendments. Now, Mitch McConnell had said from the beginning, I'm going to move to table every single amendment that they put in. Table meaning we'll get to it, because our resolution right now allows for us to have a vote on subpoenaing documents and witnesses. But that's only after the 48 hours of case management coming from the Dems, coming from the legal team. And so far, on the three votes that they've taken on amendments, Republicans have sided by party line 53 in favor of tabling. There's no indication that's going to change. So once they come back from the recess, we'll see what Mitch McConnell does. Because this, in theory, could go on forever and ever and ever. He's going to put a stop to it at some point. He's going to force a vote, and he's going to win. We'll be there live right here on AM 770 KTTA.